You're listening to Pod 4 Ham, a podcast that's all about the musical Hamilton, taking it one track at a time. Every episode features different groups of interesting people talking about a single track from the original Broadway cast recording of Hamilton. Visit us online at pod4ham, that's the numeral 4, .com. Follow us on Twitter at pod4ham, or you can visit The Incomparable at theincomparable.com.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's the 10 dual commandments.
You are listening to Pod 4 Ham. I am your moderator for this episode of the show, Moises Chu-Yan. I run ESN.FM. Joining me is a panel of, including me, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people to talk about a 1 minute, 46 second song, The 10 Dual Commandments. Joining me to my podcast right, David J. Lohr. How are you, David?
I'm good. I figure we each get two commandments. All I know is I want the one about coveting oxen. That's all I care about.
That's a very strange thing to lead with, and so I'm going to go right into saying welcome to Rachel Donner. Rachel, how are you?
I'm good.
And Shannon Sutterth, how are you?
I'm here. I'm ready to be someone's second.
Excellent. And Wendy Bowlesby, making your incomparable debut, are you ready to be the doctor on the field who's going to be well compensated?
Only after I turn around. I would prefer to have some deniability.
I think we all would at this point.
So a 1 minute, 46 second song, but in those 1 minute and 46 seconds, a lot of very important stuff rolls out and that becomes thematic throughout the whole show. We've got counting, we've got exposition being delivered in a remarkably short amount of time that cascades across the whole show. To start off with, something that's been discussed previously on Pod 4 Ham is the notion of satisfaction, the notion of getting what you're going out to get. So, Wendy, how does this play on that theme that we see throughout the show for you?
Well, the Code Duello was all about demanding satisfaction for a slight that had been committed against you. And of course, you already had that amazing number by Angelica about satisfied and the repartee between the two of them of you're never going to be satisfied. And that plays out throughout the whole show that Hamilton is never satisfied. And in this case, it's the satisfaction of the duel, like demanding that you get satisfaction. And of course, Hamilton demands satisfaction for the whole show in different ways. But what I started really thinking about is what exactly is it that he needs satisfied in this particular case? He's really angry about the slights against Washington and how those cascade down on him, right? Like if you are getting slighted, that falls down on me and I don't have your stature. So this is important to me. But why is, when you consider that his ambition seems to be his overriding trait, wouldn't he want that to be satisfied more? But he's operating against his ambition by basically going against what Washington told him to do. I mean, he plays rules lawyer and he gets Lorenz to issue the challenge, but let's be honest, it's really Hamilton who's like, somebody duel this guy. He needs to be taught a lesson. And there are so many different things that he wants in this show. Which one is it that he's truly wanting to be satisfied? And I think it shifts through the show. And I love that theme because when you look at the whole show in that context, and especially since we have three different duels to touch on, like in this first duel, it's about his ambition and his honor. In the second duel, it's his son saying, you can't talk about me like that. But his father is saying, you know, let this one go. I did tarnish my honor by sleeping with that woman. And of course, by the third one, he doesn't even really want to fight Burr, but he's still not willing to say that what he did was wrong. Like, it's just so tasty and intense, and I love it.
Something that has to be a tasty and intense experience is seeing the show. Shannon, I know that you've seen it. Rachel, have you seen the show?
Yes, but I know Shannon saw it much more recently than I have. I'm about to see it again in 3 weeks.
So I wonder.
So jealous.
I wonder if the two of you can maybe rap battle back and forth as to the rhythm and the feel of this sequence. A lot of people, myself included, kind of like, I guess, seeing it through my mind's eye and kind of imagining it, even though, you know, I've watched a large number of clips from the show, official, not official, whatever. But what's the experience of seeing this number and this back and forth?
I would say that the staging of it is extremely important because it very much mirrors, spoiler alert, the duel that happens between Burr and Hamilton at the end of the show. And there's a parallel.
And Philip and his fellow, too.
They use very similar staging.
Yeah, they're standing sort of on opposite sides. The part of the stage floor is a circle. That like a path, a circular path that will spin, so some of the actors can get carried around the circle without moving, while others are inside the circle and stationary or outside. And they tend to put the two duelists as they get ready into their positions on opposite sides. And so the actors aren't moving, but the circle is spinning and the duelists are circling. And it's super, super effective.
Yes.
The way just the motion keeps going. Even though supposedly you're just like, you know, turn around back to back 10 paces like we see in the cartoons and such. It's very different and it's very dynamic.
I want a turntable in my house. I feel like that would add a lot to dinner time.
It's sort of like a giant Lazy Susan. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, there's a lot of shows that use the circular stage technique. And we all know, and we've mentioned before, that Lynn is a huge fan of Les Mis, and I think that he is very cognizant of that. And so it feels, I would say, a lot of Jean Valjean wandering in the use of the rotating stage for Ten Duel Commandments.
Okay, it was new to me. I've seen some Broadway shows, but I've never seen the circular stage like that. But yeah, it was really effective, you know, to be spinning and moving as they're taking aim. And if I remember correctly, every time that it's time to fire, the person who gets shot is their back is to the audience and they do this sort of flop over to show that they've been hit. And then, of course, the other actors, you know, step up to take care of the wounded or, you know, clear the field for the generals coming or for whatever reason.
David, you're a playwright, a play producer, a play director, a play actor in various different respects. What is it like seeing this much otherwise expository information squeezed into this one bit of staging? Is it something that knocks your hair back each time you listen to it?
It is utterly joyous. Just the, you know, sitting and looking at the lyrics, and now that I have the book and being able, you know, because when you have, like, I bought the CDs and, you know, I'm at the point where I'm wearing glasses now. And I'm sorry, the CD booklet, the print, even with glasses and a magnifying glass, is really, really tiny. So it's nice to be able to like, have the book and be like, okay, I can pore over the lyrics. And, you know, some of it washes over you when you're just listening to it. But the care that has gone into listing these and to, you know, I think for most modern people, we think of the duel as, oh, you know, you get slapped with a glove and you meet with pistols at dawn and that's it, right? And there was a very strict code. There were very strict rules on how you perform a duel, how you take part in a duel. And so he needed to lay that all out and do it really quickly and efficiently. And under 2 minutes, that's insane. But, you know, looking through all of the levels and all the things that then echo throughout the rest of the show, in big ways and in small, like you said, the counting, the satisfaction. But even in smaller things like the focus on sinners and saints, mentioning counting your sins and or confessing your sins. I'm sorry, confessing your sins, which that's number 7. Why is it number 7 here? I don't know.
What I find interesting about number 7 is he says, pray that hell or heaven lets you in. Like, there's a different option. Like, this was pointed out in the genius notes, and I really liked the idea. Like, pray that pray that the Christian view of the universe is correct and you end up in hell or heaven, because maybe, I don't know, I guess it could be worse. But it makes it almost, it offers up the idea of maybe Hamilton was a religious. We know he went to church, but he seems, like, as an atheist myself, I can, like, a lot of his viewpoints, I'm like, I can see how he could be very skeptical. So I like that line a lot. Pray that there is something after, because it might be ending now.
Yeah. And something else that the lyrics bring in, and Rachel may have more to say on this than I do, but this was an homage to the 10 Crack Commandments by the Notorious B.I.G.
Biggie,
okay.
B.I.G., Biggie Smalls.
No, it is Notorious B.I.G.
Notorious B.I.G. He's got a few different variations on his name.
Oh, okay. All right. I learned something. Cool. but, you know, picking up on, you know, finding another song that laid out the rules, as Lin-Manuel Miranda has put it, of an illegal activity in the 90s and the 2000s dealing drugs, and the illegal activity of the 1790s of dueling. Because even though there's all these rules and all these and these keep happening, this was illegal, except in Jersey, apparently.
Everything's legal in Jersey. Rachel, do you have any hip hop beef related thoughts on this? You are our denoted hip hop scholar on the podcast.
Oh, this time. No. I hope I do at least part of this justice. So the 10 Crack Commandments, it was actually on Biggie's Life After Death album, which came out after he was killed in a drive-by.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's the 10 Crack Commandments.
This track, interestingly, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, which is pulled almost directly into 10 Dual Commandments, was actually itself lifted from Shut 'Em Down by Public Enemy, and it's a Chuck D line.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. What I use in a battle for the mind.
Biggie actually pulled the Chuck D vocal into the 10 Crack Commandments, and there was a lawsuit about it and everything. But so that's interesting in and of itself, that the rhythm and of the counting up is pulled directly from that 10 Crack Commandments. And we, like we talked about, you know, it is representing something illegal with the selling of drugs, which, interestingly, Biggie sold his drugs about 4 blocks from where I'm sitting right now in Brooklyn. Yay, gentrification. But the kind of structure here, I think what I got out of it is that the bro code, so to speak, requires some ceremony or pomp and circumstance and structure for men to process emotion. And that you have to have these complicated rules and regulations for a duel, or whether it's, you know, the drug dealer code on the street and who you sell to and who you don't sell to, and don't tell anybody about the money that you have, or how much money that you're making, or what cut that your underlings are getting, because that breaks the bro code and you'll end up getting it in the end. And that's sort of the same thing with 10 Dual Commandments, is that, you know, you have to put all this structure and rules around it so that it's okay for men to have emotions.
Men are allowed to have emotions? I'm surprised. I'm shocked. I'm baffled by this.
Yeah. I was relating it to, I'm a huge hockey fan, as Shannon knows, and I was thinking about it in relation to hockey fights, in that somebody takes a run on your goalie, somebody else on your team then takes a run at your captain in retaliation, and it's just like a duel. There's this hockey player code that they live by, and it's about how they fight and how they take runs at each other. And I think it's ridiculous, which is why I like women's hockey better, but nonetheless, it's this whole bro code that has to happen
The stick goes away. The gloves get thrown directly down to the ground, and it's off.
It's throwing the gauntlet.
Do we have anything else for the good of the order? I don't want to, you know, think that that I'm necessarily cutting this short, but it is an extraordinarily short song for as much as it accomplishes, and we could go on about a lot of the things that this song sets up, but that would be shortchanging our future duels in the show. But one of the things that I wanted to throw out there is that in keeping with part of what Wendy was saying and other things that have been brought up, I really find it interesting the way that this song knows that you can't go and belt like it's time for the 11 o'clock number. They can't go all the way to the levels of emotion that we get in the later duels. There's a certain amount that is held back, and instead we get the functional information out there. We get the rhythm for the way that these duels work out there. It gets in, gets out, and it's done. That's something that I found really appealing.
It is. It's set up, and it also is a brilliant little tiny bit of character moment as well. We've seen in previous songs how Hamilton goes for what he wants. He goes after things. He's ambitious, and he's got drive, while Burr waits for it, and Burr, you know, watches and before he makes his decision. And we've got the same kind of thing echoing here, because we've got Burr going like, can we agree these things are dumb? And Hamilton's like, yeah, but, you know, but this is going to happen because your guy was mouthing off about Washington. And Burr's like, come on, he's going to die for it. And Hamilton, you know, keeps the argument up. And so even in that tiny little snippet, we've got their personalities still in full play.
And we get a really good look at how ridiculous something like this looks on its face. And modern audiences would look at as, why would these people do something this stupid? It should go in a milk commercial. It's so dumb. what we get is the rationalization of, look, this is a time when these men and women were part of a movement to literally topple their entire government. Something that is, look, a lot of people will say things on social media and out of their mouths on cable network news, but we don't live in that kind of time where we're looking at a physical, aggressive, violent overthrow of the government. It's very much something that I
for, not overthrow for me, the government, but God help me, I work in a high school. I see a little bit of this on a regular basis.
Yeah, wars begin and end, oceans rise, empires fall each time the bell rings.
The other thing about this specific duel is that as the duels go through the show, this one is really inconsequential. It's like, oh, you insulted Washington. Ah, whereas the next one, a little more important. And then the last one is really a serious, at least to Burr and Hamilton, a serious breach, a serious attack on Burr's own principles. And it's, you know, it's more than just, oh, you're saying things out of turn, or, oh, you insulted my guy. So I kind of like that this is how it starts. This one really is immature.
What I like about that in terms of Lynn really knowing how to structure a show is he understands much. I used to be an English teacher, and they always told us that if you're going to teach process, you have to keep the content light. If you're going to teach content, they need to already know how to do whatever it is you're having them do. So before we can get into the heavy emotional content of Philip or Hamilton and Burr at the end, first we have to teach the process. And that's what this number does beautifully. It teaches you about the duel so that when we come back to it later, you already know what's going on. And so you can get, and so that means you're not both trying to understand what's happening and being devastated by the emotional content too. So I give full props for that.
Do we have some final thoughts on Ten Duel Commandments, where it fits for you in the hierarchy of songs, whether general importance to the show, direct importance to you, you know, anything? Let's go around the horn. I guess maybe we can start with Rachel.
I love the beat in this song. It's definitely something when I saw the show live, I was nodding my head to the beat during it. And I love the staging of it. And it really kind of opened it up for me in a way that just listening to it didn't. And I think it's also interesting that the duel itself happens, but it ends with the word fire. And the aftermath is a completely separate song, which listeners will hear about next. So I thought it was an interesting end point for the song as well.
Shannon?
yeah, similarly, the staging really makes the show. So, you know, when you get the chance to, you know, if great performances, when that finally comes out this fall, or if you get the chance to grab a ticket, yeah, it's really amazing because, you know, it's very dynamic. It brings it to life. And this song sets up such a really important thread throughout the rest of the show, both thematically and musically. As Wendy said earlier, satisfaction, something that ran through my head back then that I didn't say at the time, though, that struck me was another person looking for satisfaction but not acting the way Hamilton wants satisfaction here and doesn't act was how Thomas Jefferson, when he wants dirt on Hamilton, is like he'll confront Hamilton but give him something first to work with. That the motifs, the way they repeat and help unify the show, is masterful.
Wendy?
There are two things that delighted me when I first started listening to the whole soundtrack in specific to this song. The first was the rhyme of ruinous with doing this. Like, yes. When I first heard that, I think I clapped my hands and laughed out loud.
It's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous, and nobody says ruinous anymore, and I feel like, yeah, let's bring that back.
Well, the whole phrase is you know, pure period slang or language, and then he's rhyming it with modern language, phrasing.
It pulls
which is beautiful.
Them both together. It's like an immediate bridge between the two places in time. It's masterful, and it's elegant, and it's delightful. It's wordplay of the highest order. The second thing that delighted me was after listening to the whole thing, that like motifs the first time through help you anchor things on an emotional level that you don't realize, and you don't really notice them until repeat listenings. When Philip is counting with his mother during their piano lesson, and it's the exact same counting melodically and rhythmically as the dual counting, once I noticed that, I got shivers up my spine. Because then, even all the way back in this song, they're already foreshadowing this horrible moment. I tend to stop listening right about that point. Like, I find myself busy and like, I'm just going to turn off the soundtrack now and I'll just start up tomorrow right at the beginning again. And I'll just pretend that they lived happy lives and everybody was fine. Because I start weeping in the middle of Philip's death and I don't stop for about 20 minutes. So, yeah, that's all I got.
Setting up lots of sadness and tears, otherwise known as David Lohr. David, what do you think? Final thoughts.
I'm hurt now. I'm crying. Yeah, that was one of the things I was going to bring up is the counting, not just that it's foreshadowing when Philip is practicing his French or his piano, but that it's also a countdown because, I mean, I've said this on other episodes. I've said this with my son who... I said to him right off the bat when he fell in love with it, I said, okay, what are the two things you've learned about Hamilton in school? And he goes, well, he's on money and he got shot in a duel. Those are the only things he's ever learned about Hamilton at school. And that's all I had ever known from my schooling 30 something years ago. And so we go into this knowing that he's going to die in a duel. And this basically says, yes, there's a duel. Here's a countdown, and it becomes, it's not a clock, but it is essentially, in writing terms, a ticking clock until the end of the show. And every time it comes back, it reminds you that, oh, it's coming. Something's coming. He's going to die. Which, again, you know, just being able to place that and refer to it and come back to it and weave it in and out of all the other elements of the shows, it's just amazing.
There's a reference on the Genius Notes that I loved that talked about having the duels repeat like this mean that by the time you get to Hamilton's duel, it is so familiar that it feels like a memory. I imagine death so much it feels like a memory. Whoever pointed that out, that was genius. Like, yes, yes. It was a genius note on genius.com.
Well, and by that point in the show, you don't need to be paying attention to what's happening, right? Or you don't need to be paying so much attention to the details of the duel so much as who's there and what they're going through, because you already know this now.
And they get more introspective. Like the Philip one is still pretty external. And then by the time you get to the third one, it's so introspective.
Well, far be it for me to claim that a song that includes a lot of numerology and maybe a little bit of math might just unlock the equation that is Hamilton, the genius math equation that that doesn't get the kind of credit that things from Hawking and Einstein do. I wanted to thank once again our panelists for this episode of the show. Rachel Donner, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Shannon Sutterth, once again, the honor is all mine.
Always a pleasure.
Mr. David J. Lohr. Are you still kicking around over there?
Somewhat. I mean, I've imagined this episode so much it feels like a memory.
Boo.
And Wendy Bowlesby, also right here in Austin, Texas. Thank you so much for joining me once again.
This has been absolutely delightful. Thank you.
And I know that some people might think that five total panelists for a song that lasts a minute and 46 seconds might seem excessive, but we had to have two duelists, we had to have 2 seconds, we had to have a doctor on the field. You can sort it out for yourself who they are, but rest assured that the doctor was paid in advance. We treated him with civility, and in the event that we screwed any of this up, I think we can claim deniability, yes? Join us next time on Pod for Ham, where you're going to meet us inside, meet us inside.
Number 9.
Look him in the eye, ain't no higher. Summon all the courage you require. Then count
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Number 10 paces fire.
I did want to say, I think using hip hop, especially because to us now it seems weird that you would shoot somebody over an argument. Except that is what a lot of gangsta rap is about, is, you know, they talk about all the different ways, like, their reputation is so important, and you can't bring me down, and I'm willing to grab a gun and come after you. So I love how those two tie together, because it does allow that emotional connection to where you might be standing there going, really, you're going to shoot him over an insult? And it's like, well, you know what, I hear it every day on my radio. When you put it in that context, I get where you're coming from.
To be fair, I'd throw in that it's something that is a theme throughout hip hop that isn't just tied to gangster rap or explicit gun violence. It's something that goes into rap battles where the goal was just one-upping one another, and things were dueled in verse. Yeah, they were the ways that these people resolved arguments at the birth of hip hop, honestly. And one of the things that I think gets constantly bundled into, well, this is, you know, and I'm not saying that you're saying this necessarily, Wendy, but I just, you know, I like throwing it out there, is that all hip hop is necessarily associated with gangster rap. And a lot of people who associate a negative connotation with hip hop itself, they think it's nothing but gangster rap. It's nothing but the violence. And they don't look at some of the full on, you know, street poetry that is really where hip hop came from. And of course, the biggest, flashiest, most violent version of it is the thing that it gets associated with as what's typical, I guess.
My disclaimer, I am by no means a hip hop expert. So
we're going to make you one by the end of this podcast.
Honest to God, Lynn has gotten me a lot more interested in it. And it's not that I had any disdain for the form. I'm just of a certain age and I was more of a Broadway girl. So, yeah. So please, anybody, please don't think that I meant that I was being blasé or cheap in my reference there.
Not at all. And I think it's an important viewpoint that, you know, we need to recognize and understand that a lot of it is that this show for a lot of people is their introduction to hip hop. Out of curiosity, Rachel, what was your introduction to hip hop?
God, I don't even remember.
It's always been part of the fabric of your life.
I feel like it has. The one album I remember, I actually had to buy a second tape, because yes, I listened to it mostly on cassette tape, was Beastie Boys' License to Ill. I wore out that tape and had to get a new one. But I've been listening to hip hop ever since.
Yeah, for me, it would be more like singles. Singles would catch me and I'd, like, you know, turn up the radio every time I heard them. And then when Napster and then iTunes, and you could, like, actually just grab singles, I would grab the things I liked.
Yeah, Public Enemy was definitely pretty strong for me as well, because that was so vastly different than the early kind of party celebration rap. And this was really something strong that brought up social issues and the African-American community relationship with the police that was sometimes challenging.
Sometimes challenging, and, aka always challenging.
Yes.